Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Thomas. Mr. Sims.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul E. Sims, and I represent appellant Sheila Thomas, and by consent of my co-counsels in this matter, the other appellants. I stand before you today asking that the guilty verdicts be vacated and this case be remanded to the district court for a judgment of acquittal or an alternate a grant of a new trial. In support thereof, I would state that the playing of the Macintosh DVD town hall meeting in its entirety during the trial and during the government's closing was, among other things, improper bolstering of a witness and intentional error by Assistant U.S. Attorney Carr. Reversal.
Is that DVD? Were we favored with that, Mr. Sims?
Yes, Your Honor.
When was that sent to the court?
We delivered, my co-counsel in this matter personally delivered a DVD this morning. Under Kotikos versus United States, a reversal is required for a non-constitutional error if it has substantial and injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict. Kotikos states that if, when all is said and done, the conviction is sure that the error did not influence the jury or had but a very slight effect, the verdict and the judgment should stand, except perhaps where the departure is from a constitutional norm. However, the court also states that if one cannot say with fair assurance, after pondering all that happened without stripping the erroneous action from the whole, and that the judgment was not substantially swayed by the error, it is impossible. And I repeat, it is impossible to conclude that substantial rights were not affected. The inquiry cannot be merely whether there was enough to support the result apart from the phase affected by the error. It is rather, even so, whether the error itself has substantial influence.
What is Macintosh actually saying on this tape, since we haven't seen it yet, since it was just submitted today?
Mr. Macintosh.
It was a campaign speech, right?
Yes, it was a, as the court paraphrased, it was a self-gratuitous speech on how he was going to help the city of East St. Louis and how the FBI supported his faction.
Well, that part of it was put in by the defense, right? The part having to do his statements about the FBI.
That statement by the FBI.
And then the prosecutor asked to submit the whole thing.
And that's correct,
for context.
Right. That is correct.
So what about the other parts of the tape that were not put in by the defense
that was so harmful? That was, and I'm, excuse me if I'm cutting you off, that was the gratuitous statements about what he was going to do to help the city, how he was going to create more jobs,
It's just a political speech. It's a politician making promises. And how did that?
That because this witness, when he was on the stand, had, for all intents and purposes, created perjury with very conflicting statements. His credibility was, in my opinion, my humble opinion, was wasted.
Well, how did his own campaign speech operate to bolster his own credibility? I find that
because it took the jury's, in my opinion, it took the jury's attention away from all of the misstatements and all of the inaccurate statements that this witness had made, all the prejudicial statements that he had made. It then turned to, one of the jurors stated to a reporter after the trial, we just thought Mr. Macintosh was trying to help the city. So I assert that this video was improper bolstering of this witness. And the fact that the juror made that statement goes to show that there was a influence by this DVD on the minds of the juror.
When did the juror make that statement, Mr. Sims?
It was immediately after the trial.
And that was an interview with someone?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in my appendix,
yeah.
Exhibit 1. As I was stating, the fact that the Assistant United States Attorney Carr would use this DVD in his closing is proof that the government thought that the DVD would have an effect on the jury. And the statement made by Mr. Lamont Reed is just further evidence that it did indeed have that effect. I would also assert that the trial court erred because, in the light most favorable to the government, several conspiracies were proved, which was at variance with the superseding indictment returned in this case alleging one conspiracy. Under Guerrero-Marez, there are three major factors to determine if there are multiple conspiracies. Those factors are the existence of a common goal, the nature of the agreement, and the overlap of the participants. In the instant case, we have different goals. We have the goal of the Democratic Party headed by Powell, which was to elect the Democratic ticket. We have the goal of the A-team, which was headed by Ellis, and their goal was to elect Ellis. Now, under United States versus Barlin, multiple conspiracies exist where the evidence shows separate networks operating independently of one another. It was the government's witness, Stith, who testified that the meeting with the A-team and Mr. Kern was to develop their own relationship with Mr. Kern, so they didn't have to go through Charlie Powell. And the letters to the Republican judges, which were meant to intimidate these judges, were done without Powell's knowledge or consent. This goes to show that there was a multiple conspiracy because the A-team was operating independently and without the knowledge of Charlie Powell. If there is a variance, then that does not give cause for the case to be overturned unless that variance prejudiced the defendant's rights. And in United States versus Reed, there are two questions that the court should ask. Could a reasonable jury determine beyond a reasonable doubt that a single conspiracy existed? And did the defendant suffer substantial prejudice if one or more of those conspiracies existed? If we go back to Katikos, a variance is prejudicial because the danger of transference of guilt in the minds of jury from one conspiracy to another. In this case, there was the actions of the A-team that was so pronounced and so detrimental to the other co-defendants in this case. There was evidence of intimidation. There was evidence of vote buying. There was the different objectives. And under Castro, which this case runs parallel to, there were two conspiracies that did not have a common objective. In this case, we have two conspiracies that did not have a common objective. Under Castro, there was no substantial identity of facts and participants involving similar acts in furtherance of a common plan.
Mr. Timms, if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, this is the time to do it.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll also state that the trial court erred in verdicts against the defendant because the verdict against defendant Thomas was contrary to law because no proof was made that defendant Thomas paid or told someone to pay for voting.
Thank you. Mr. Cueto, I assume you want to wait until after the United States has argued so you can argue the cross appeal. Mr. Carr.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Good morning, counsel. Your Honor, if I could, I would like to address our cross-appeal, first of all, not to minimize the arguments that we've put in our brief relating to the defense, what defense has already brought up. But I'd like to address my comments to our cross-appeal, which deals with the court, Judge Murphy, failing to include Section 3B1.3, the abuse of a position of public and private trust enhancement under the guidelines in the sentencing as it applied to Chairman Charles Powell Jr. When I say chairman, I'm talking about the fact that he was chairman of the East St. Louis Democratic Precinct Committee.
Who elects him?
The individual 44 precinct committeemen from East St. Louis elect him, but then to be in that position, to be elected, he, of course, has to be an elected precinct committeeman, who would have been elected by voters within his precinct in one of those 44 precincts in East St. Louis. It is the government's position, and I think you probably said that, I know you've read the brief and you've probably seen it, the government's position that the three elected precinct committeemen that were co-defendants with Chairman Powell received this enhancement for abuse of position of trust. I understand that counsel is suggesting that there was not an objection. There, in fact, were objections. There were pre-sentence reports for each of those defendants that were prepared by probation. There were rulings with respect to each of those three defendants at their sentencing hearings, which all occurred prior to Powell's sentencing. And the timing of this is somewhat significant in terms of the reasonableness of what happened. For instance, for Ms. Thomas, Mr. Sims appeared and indicated that he believed that it was in fact a public trust, and you can find that in our appendix. We've set out just little excerpts of these transcripts. I believe, yes, it is a public trust, Your Honor. It's at Government Appendix Number 7. The court nonetheless imposed the...
In what way did the defendant abuse the Democratic Party's trust? As I understand the basic argument in this case, the basic argument in this prosecution, the Democratic Party in East St. Louis had a policy of buying votes. And in that, under those circumstances, it would have abused the position of trust not to have bought votes.
Your Honor, it's our position that the criminals had a policy to buy votes.
Was the Democratic Party of East St. Louis was a bunch of criminals.
It was, and they received money.
That's the problem. You're essentially arguing that if this were a prosecution of Al Capone's mob in Chicago, you would be arguing that it was an abuse of a position of trust to have engaged in bootlegging.
No, I don't
even
think
though
so.
The mob wanted the people to engage in bootlegging.
Well, let me tell you where I think the difference is. I think this abusive position of trust applies when there's discretion involved. And your example with Mr. Capone, if somebody didn't do what Mr. Capone did, there was no discretion involved. Here, there is discretion. There is money that flows from the St. Clair County Democratic Party to the East St. Louis Democratic Party. The discretion that those individual precinct committee people have in the expenditure of those funds is what goes to the heart of this abusive position of trust.
Are we to presume it, or is what Judge Murphy's done here is suggest you just didn't put anybody on the stand from the Democratic Party, whether St. Clair or or more regional, to say it was an abuse? Are we just to presume that it's an abuse?
No, but I think that
who did you put on to indicate that they abused the trust of the Democratic Party?
On February the 13th, this court at Government Appendix 33 was told by the district court, this actually took two hearings, that it was going to apply that guideline.
Right.
It indicated that it was. It indicated that it had found, based upon having been in trial and listened to the 5 weeks of trial, that it had found that he'd abused that trust.
Right.
And that it applied.
But he changed his mind.
And then he changed his mind, and his change is, I've changed my mind. That's what he said. Reasonableness would indicate, number one, that you'd have some explanation of why it is that you changed your mind.
Did he give any explanation of why of the original decision, other than his conclusion that it occurred?
Well, he indicated that he adopted the pre-sentence report, which had an indication about what the evidence is, that he had observed the evidence. He specifically says that, and again, I'll direct the court. Basically, it's in the government appendix between 29 and 33. Where it is that he's talking about that the jury made these findings. This was a Powell's involvement in this conspiracy was as the chairman telling people that he would approve their budgets to go buy votes.
Defendants got the enhancement.
Pardon me.
The other defendants got the
enhancement.
And they were committeemen.
They were elected precinct committeemen.
And he was the elected chairman.
He was an elected precinct committeeman as well, and he was also elected by them as chairman of the Democratic Party.
So we
think that he should have got, as an elected precinct committeeman, this enhancement. We think that he should have got and could have got as an elected chairman of that party this enhancement, and we think that he should have got the enhancement because of the leadership, which obviously the court gave. But let me get back to the reasonableness of this. Now, assume that you're walking in as a litigant, and the court has indicated that he's going to assign these two levels. That in all of the previous sentencings, he's done it. You show up in court, and the court says, "I've changed my mind." He doesn't get it. No explanation. Reason dictates that what you being you, me being me, he being him, we may differ about whether or not we agree with the judge, but reason dictates we ought to be able to find here, we ought to find the tracks. How is it that you came to this conclusion? It's not reasonable just to say, "I changed my mind."
Did the government did you engage in any dialogue, Mr. Carr, with Chief Judge Murphy? Asking for some reasons when he made that, when he changed his position?
I guess the record is what it is. We took the position that the court was incorrect and that it should be both a public and private trust, and we still take that position that it's both a public and private trust. Again, getting back to the situation that we found ourselves in, he is then telling a room full of people like here that you need to call a witness, I suppose, to say that this is an abuse of trust.
That's
Let me tell
way,
you how it is,
way,
how unreasonable that we think that is from a policy perspective. Let's say me, not being a Democrat, as a Republican, I decide I want to make a contribution to the Democratic Party, which is done all the time because I have a friend. I make that contribution. I have a reasonable belief that people will not be spending my contribution to go buy votes. I'm not the only person. There are PACs that make those contributions, and to narrowly construe this 3B1.3 as just some private little PAC ignores the fact that we have election laws that require campaign disclosure of your funds. You have to disclose those funds. When you don't pay that, when you don't use them in your own campaign, there are laws that would allow for the remainder to be given to other candidates, to be given to the St. Clair County Department. There are laws about that because this, in fact, is in the public domain. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are public trusts. And when people provide money to those parties.
Whoa.
When people provide money to those.
The Republican parties are themselves public trusts? I thought they were private organizations devoted to engaging in speech.
In the context of how they spend their money, it is the government's position that that is a public trust that will not be misspent.
That's a really novel doctrine. I think the parties themselves would deny any such claim. The argument that something is a public trust usually means it's subject to lots of public regulation. These are not public entities. They are private organizations.
Subject to a lot of public regulation. There are regulations on campaign financing, and to suggest that the government would have to call...
You don't want to rest your argument on this proposition.
Well, we would certainly rest our argument if the court is not of a mind to say that it's a public trust. Then it's certainly a private trust. Anybody that makes a contribution is entitled to believe that the money that is being sent there is not going to be used to buy votes. And we feel like that the court was unreasonable.
Well, that's my inquiry, I think, Mr. Carr. Let's assume it is a private trust for just a second. If it's the American Cancer Society or whatever group one might describe, do you need, and that's why I'm asking whether this is where Chief Judge Murphy's coming from, do you need somebody to say that what he was about was not advancing the policy of X group, but rather a breach of the trust of advancing that policy? Is that a fair reading, or do you think we have to remand it to find out what he means?
I don't know that it would equate to the American Cancer Society or how this would
Well, I'm
equate.
Just talking, would, I'm just taking just a private say, group. Let's okay. get away from public, because I share Chief Judge Easterbrook's concern about you're going down that path of whether that's because then every minor political party becomes a public trust, I guess, you know, you name it, then whether or not that's the case, I don't want to go there. But considering it a private trust for a second, whether there's a breach by a major figure, do you need to have some person in policy position say that it's not advancing the cause, in this case, vote buying?
I don't think under these circumstances, when you had a 5-week trial and the court has told you that it's listened to the evidence, the jury's made its finding, that the evidence is that I understand there were tape recordings of the defendant telling people as chairman that you know, there comes a time when people expect something, and if they don't get what they expect, they'll hold it against you for life. Under those circumstances, how could you not find that what the jury found incorporates this abuse of a position of trust? And really, that's where we're coming from. In terms of the other arguments that the defendants have made, I will just point out factually about the closing argument and the DVD that was being discussed. I sat through the opening statements, and in opening statement, Mr. Powell's attorney talked for almost an hour and a half about how the Republican Party had conspired to throw this election and used Mr. McIntosh to throw an election to change the power in East St. Louis. He did this by suggesting that the President of the United States had appointed the Attorney General, who had appointed the United States Attorney, who had appointed the Assistant United States Attorney, to prosecute this. And mixed in there, we went to the FBI and how that person got appointed, and that the FBI ultimately was responsible for helping throw this election, and I will present evidence, concrete evidence, of how it is that that occurred. That's what this tape is. It's got a defendant sticker on it, and I was just like the comment that you made. All right, it's just a campaign speech. So what? That's why it is that I asked to have the first part of it played. It was played in that context. It was then later used for some impeachment purposes. But it was used, the last half of it was used for three times. Then fully played, and the court right before closing argument indicated that we could make full use of everything beforehand. For the court to suggest that it just came in as a prior inconsistent statement, the court was just mistaken. The court did not accept argument when it made the ruling. Even at the time afterwards, counsel for defendant Powell indicated that he'd made direct use of that. So under those circumstances, if it was an error at all, certainly harmless error. When we have tape recordings of each and every one of those individuals talking about buying votes or, admitting that they bought votes. With that, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Cueto.
May it please the court.
Mr. Carr.
Obviously, I stand before you asking you to affirm the conviction or the sentence imposed on my client, Charlie Powell. The district court did not apply the enhancement of an abuse of public or private trust. I want to clean something up that distinguishes Mr. Powell from the other defendants. In the appendix to our brief, I was not trial counsel, but trial counsel did provide more legal argument. And the legal argument that he applied, that he sent, was state law, which said that a party official, Democrat or Republican, acts as a private entity, and the only discipline that could be imposed upon him is from the party itself, the party officials. Now, so that was, and what Justice, I'm sorry, what Judge Murphy said was then, he analogized that after receiving more legal argument. He analogized it to those cases like under the 14th Amendment in a Section 1983 case where you look to state law to see if there's a due process or whether there's a liberty or property interest such that due process applies. So that was the legal analysis applied by Judge Murphy.
Why is that a relevant legal analysis?
It's relevant because of this, and it ties into what Mr. Carr was saying. In order to apply this enhancement, the abuse of public trust, the discretion that Mr. Carr says that underpins the alliance or this enhancement, the discretion must be imposed by the public, to kind of underline what Justice Easterbrook was coming. In other words, if you look at the commentary to this enhancement, it mentions three situations where it could be applied. A lawyer is a fiduciary. We take oaths. We are subject to licensing requirements. We owe duties to the public.
What any of that has to do with anything, right? The idea of the position of trust is that you are exercising discretion in a position where trust substitutes for verification. In normal market transactions, one verifies. In positions of trust, one has to rely on discretion. Now, the defendants here, were certainly spending monies that had been contributed and therefore were within the discretion of other people. They weren't going to be verified. It was going to be trust. So it seems to me you're driven to the kind of argument that I was just making, which was that the Democratic organization in East St. Louis was basically a RICO enterprise, and therefore the only thing its trusted subordinates could do would be to violate the law. To do anything else would be a breach of trust. Is that your position?
If I could restate it, perhaps, is that I hate to call it a RICO organization. I mean, my client was never convicted of RICO, so it's hard for me to say here that it was a RICO organization. But the criminality itself, if the criminality that was proven and that I have to accept as, you know, that the jury found here, there was no discretion by the public on Mr. Powell to do it in a legal way.
That's just a different problem. Positions that entail private entrustment are covered by the guidelines. You just have to assume that.
Oh, that's true. It's a public or private trust.
Why don't you address my question? Do you have an argument if one rejects the position that I've just articulated, which is that the Democratic Organization of East St. Louis is basically a criminal organization, and therefore the only thing the precinct committee members can do to carry out their responsibilities is to buy votes? Is that your position?
Not in its totality. I can't accept the notion that was their only function, or even the only function to do that. It seems to me that it extends beyond.
Is your position that your client would have abused the trust reposed in him had he refused to buy votes in this primary?
No, I don't think I can say that, Justice Easterbrook. I don't believe I can say that.
Then you lose.
Well, then, okay. Then if the only that if the position proved then that that was that it was that there was no functional equivalent in terms of the criminality between the Democratic Party of East St. Louis and Al Capone's mob.
No. That's not at all what I was saying. The question is, what is the obligation of a precinct committee man in East St. Louis?
It could be to
run an honest election, or it could be to buy votes. Now, if the marching orders of a precinct committeeman are to buy votes, then no position of trust has been abused. If, on the other hand, the marching orders are to run a clean election, then a position of trust has been abused. You have to choose which of these things it is.
Well, then I'll choose the latter. Or I'm sorry, Judge. The position, or the East St. Louis Democratic Party existed to turn out the vote, however it could be done, and if that's that's what I choose. Can I say this, though? Back to whether or not they imposed, there was a witness that testified to this. These were sweeping conspiracies. My client was only charged with the conspiracy, not the substantive offense. Whether or not these budgets and the expenditures.
Thank you, Mr. Cueto.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I just ask one question? What do you make of the change of Chief Judge Murphy's position? I asked that of Mr. Carr. I mean, do you assess it as a failure of proof?
I do, and as well as a change of mind based upon the pleading filed that challenged it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sims, anything further? Not much you need to rebut.
Counsel made a statement about the tapes, and I would just like to address that the only thing that they have on tape with my client, Sheila Thomas, is the statement when asked by Mr. McIntosh, did they pay voters? She said the money was taken her, and I'm paraphrasing this, the money was taken from her, and we paid everybody. It does not state. There is no evidence that she told someone to pay somebody. It's no evidence that, as a matter of fact, there's no evidence is when she got this knowledge, when she gained this knowledge. And under U.S. versus Falcone, evidence must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the conspiracy was formed and that that person who was claimed to have been a member of that first conspiracy knowingly participated in the unlawful plan with the intent to advance it or further some purpose of it. No evidence that Thomas knew of the vote buying before the election, and there was no evidence as to when she gained this knowledge that there was vote buying. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. And Mr. Sims, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.